Accession number 6287, Reel 3.
Mr. Hood, Reel 3.
We saw this as being a kind of turning one's face to the wall. So he was simply dumped out of his bunk and put under a shower because we felt that he was in danger, actually.
Did you, in fact, come across people who just faded away because of loss of morale?
No, I don't think I saw any of that at all. What one did see were the effects of hunger. For instance, in this camp, which was Camp 21 at Kieti, there was one officer who became obsessed with his daily ration of bread, which again was one roll of bread a day. And he kept them all in the box but didn't eat them, which is a typical starvation neurosis. But he couldn't eat them because he was so hungry that he needed to keep them, because if he didn't keep them, he wouldn't be able to survive. And he was in, I can't remember what happened to him. he was in a bad way. But on the whole, we were amazingly healthy. People got very depressed at times. And there was a very curious convention in the camp, which was that if somebody sat down outside and covered himself with his blanket, that you didn't disturb him, because that was him demanding privacy. One of the main problems of being in a camp like that being, of course, that you cannot ever get away from people. I was in one of the small rooms in my bungalow with 9 other people, and it was a room about, 15 by 9 or 10 feet across. And, it was just very difficult to live with people in such close conditions for a long period of time.
Do you think everybody felt this lack of privacy?
Yes, I think so. I think a lot of people felt it, and really felt they had somehow to establish some way that they could be, as it were, by themselves and just have a kind of respite from this total need to interact all the time.
Did you find that there was constant interference in what you regarded as your own private preserve?
No, people were very good about that. So territories were very clearly defined. You couldn't interfere with people. It was very difficult, and in fact I think it would have been dangerous to disrupt activities when people had got them going. I had one very close friend who was killed in Normandy, who was unpopular. He was a very tactless man, very nice, very tactless. And he was very brash and kept putting his foot in it. And he had problems. He would, people took against him. He also snored at night, and people used to throw boots at him at night. But that was, and he was sort of picked on a bit in that way. But he was a marvellous man. I loved him very much. People had, if one's going to survive, one had to respect other people, I think. Otherwise, I think you've gone around the bend, really.
Were there any mental breakdowns?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Or suicides?
No suicides, no, nothing of that kind. I never came across anything like that. I think actually the camp was such a hive of activity, eventually, with all kinds of language lessons. There was a kind of miniature university going on, with people from every possible walk of life. And if you wanted to, you could study almost anything in that camp, and did do.
How did you see your role as a communist in the camps? Did you feel that you had a duty to perform as a communist, or did you just forget about it?
Well, no. The line, the Communist Party line, was that one must be a good soldier, because that was a way you would win respect, and people might actually listen to you. So one had to be a good soldier. One had to be as able to do things as other people. And, simply what I did was, and this was a kind of spontaneous thing, because it was simply my interest. I had long political discussions with people. I gave a lecture on, I think, the party, in which I thought I was talking about it as if I didn't belong to it. And no, just one just had to set an example, one way or another. So that if you were going along with the system, you had to be very good at that. And if you began against, went against the system, you had to show that you had, you were good at that too, that you were ballsy in a good way, so to speak. So that you won respect one way or another. That was really what it was about, I think.
But did you form any kind of communist organisation in the camps?
No, there were, I think, two other party members whom I eventually sussed out. And we just, as happened in the army, we simply had an understanding. You know, it was usually very easy to detect who were communist party members, but you usually didn't say so openly. You simply use certain words, and if they responded in certain ways, then you knew that who they were. As, for instance, in a transit camp in Iraq, an Indian Army transit camp, I was sitting next to the adjutant, who was a Gurkha, an officer from a Gurkha battalion, and he said something in the course of a discussion with some very conservative Indian Army officers, which caused me to turn to him and say, do you know my Uncle Harry, i.e. Harry Pollitt? And he said, come outside, will you? So we went outside and said, of course I know Harry Pollitt. So, yeah, but when recognised simply by a word like that.
My Uncle Harry was a kind of phrase used in the Communist Party at the time, was
Uncle
it?
Uncle Harry.
Harry Pollitt. But when you came across the other two communists in the POW camp, and you suspected from what they said that they must be communists, did you actually say to them in private, are you a member of the party?
No, I don't think we did. I don't remember. I don't think so. We simply got involved in activities of political discussion and things of that sort.
To what extent did you have contact with Italian civilians outside the wire?
None at all. Absolutely none. No, you never saw any. Occasionally, if we went out on these little route marches we did, we saw people passing, but otherwise we saw no Italian civilians. People who fell ill, there were one or two people who fell ill, who had to be taken to hospital, they met civilians, and seemed to have been well treated. There was one officer who had an extremely bad squint, and one of the Italian medical officers was very worried by this and said, look, I could cure that for you, and did eventually have him taken to hospital and operated on his squint.
Successfully?
Yes, very successfully. On the other hand, there was another Italian medical officer who, with whom I had a very angry interview, who said that it was very interesting that we suffered from desert sores. I don't know whether you know about that, but in the desert, the British Army, the Germans don't seem to have suffered as much, but in the British Army, if you broke the skin, it developed into a sore which became quite large, about the size of a 10p piece or bigger, and very difficult to get rid of, and all over one's arms or legs. Very nasty. And for some reason I had to go and see this, not medically, I had to go and see this Italian major, medical officer, who began to explain to me that, of course, we were all syphilitic. And that is what all these sores were, the really chankers, and you know, it just really showed what sort of shits we all were. So I had a terrible shouting match with him, which I think was one of the things that led to my demotion, so to speak.
To what extent could you keep abreast of what was happening in the war?
Oh, very well, because we got Italian newspapers. We didn't have a radio receiver, but we had Italian newspapers. And we developed this... I had to do a lot of this, but other people could read Italian too. We developed the skill of reading Italian newspapers so as to know what was actually happening. For instance, if an Italian communique talked about our glorious soldiers advanced another 5 kilometres, we discovered that this usually meant that in fact being a retreat. And you could decode the language, so to speak. It was a very depressing time to be in camp, of course, because the Germans were at Alamein, and they were at Stalingrad, and they were in the Caucasus. And it was really extremely depressing to watch. You know, we kept a map of Russia and watched the Germans going on and on and on and on, and wondered a lot about what would happen at Alamein up until the 23rd of October, obviously. But even after that, the situation in Russia was not good all that winter. But we could follow all that, and we had a fair idea what was happening. And you eventually were able to decode the verbiage in the Italian press and get some impression of what was actually going on. Plus these odd things that came in from the Carabinieri, about things which are not mentioned in the press, but which they would mention.
Can you tell me how the Italian collapse in 1943 affected you?
Yes, by this time, of course, I was in another camp. I was moved up to Camp 49 near Parma as an undesirable prisoner. And I was very lucky, actually, because Camp 21, where I was, nearly everybody was taken by the Germans and taken to Germany. That's a story in itself, what happened there, which you might want to know about. Anyway, I was transferred to Camp 49 near Parma, which was in an orphanage, a small camp. I don't know, about 300 officers in beds, in real beds, with a very decent camp commandant. And partly because we were sitting right in the middle of the Parma cheese production and all that dairy produce, most amazing food, butter, cheese, all kinds of things, which I think were being sold on the black market and being bought with... by the camp funds, obviously. Anyway, on the day that Mussolini fell, I was at a window on the first floor beside my bed early in the morning. And outside there was a double belt of wire, and in between the two belts of wire were the camp offices. And the commandant's office faced me, yes? And I could see into his office, and above his desk was a large portrait of Mussolini. So I was looking out quite idly when I saw an ordinary soldier of the garrison come along, go into the commandant's office, climb on the desk, take down Mussolini's portrait and stamp on it, jump all over it. So I said, something has happened. And this was the deposition of Mussolini at the Grand Consiglio, the Fascist Grand Council. And following that, we began to get from the Italian press began to appear with big blanks censored on the front page. But from it, for instance, I remember seeing in La Stampa, the big Turin paper, I remember seeing a photograph of a huge crowd being addressed in the public by politicians whose names I didn't know. And there was also a news item saying that one of the Italian communist leaders, Giovanni Roveda, had been released and was now active. So it was clear that something had happened. And the question then was what? And it was very difficult, actually. We had heard from the Carabinieri at this camp of the big strikes in Turin in the spring of that year. They had confirmed what we knew about that. So clearly something was going on, and the question was what on earth was happening and what should we do about it. So that was in July, the fall of Mussolini. From July through August, we were in a state of considerable suspense and turmoil, wondering what precisely was going to happen. We knew that the Allies had landed in Sicily. What were they going to do? What was going to happen next? And then came the 8th of September. And our senior British officer was Colonel de Burgh, who eventually was in charge of the mission for tracking down and repatriating escaped prisoners of war. He was called to camp commandant's office, and the camp commandant appears to explain to him that the Germans were on the way to take over the camp, that he intended to resist them, that he didn't have enough weapons to arm us, but he would cut the wire and let us all out. So somebody got a bugle, and a bugler sounded the fall in. And Colonel de Berg explained the situation, said we're not going to go out. And we could see the Italians were digging in like machine guns just down the road. So we went out to the back of the camp in a compact body and made our way around the back of the village where the camp was, and eventually ended up in a deep, we call it a wadi, a valley, very typical of that part of Lombardy, very steep defiles filled with shrubs and acacia bushes and things like that, so very good cover. And we stayed there overnight. And I was asked to go back into the village and have a look and see what was happening. Nothing much seemed to be happening. So we came back again. And I had found myself alongside a captain in the Gurkhas who'd always stood in front of me at roll call, but I didn't know him particularly well. And he said to me, you know, I think we've got to do something, and if we decide to go away, should we go together? So I said yes. I thought it was idiotic to sit about any longer in this place, in a large body of people. People were going to drift off anyway. So we set off together, and the first thing we did was we went to a peasant house and traded in our battle dresses for civilian clothes. And curiously enough, the name of the family was Tedeschi, which means Germans in Italian. But they were marvellous people. And we stayed with them for 2 or 3 days. The rest, this was quite a bit away from where the main body of people were. And we helped them with the maize harvest. And then I said that I thought really that it was dangerous to stay in the plain. We must make for the hills. So we set out and we walked up into the Apennines, made for the Apennines.
Why should it have been more dangerous in the plain than in the hills?
Because it's, you know, flat for miles around, and it's much easier to search for people. And the Germans were clearly going to, and the fascist militia were clearly going to have a big search operation sooner or later. And a lot of people were in fact taken not long after. So we made for the hills and walked. The way we went on was we would go to a peasant house and say, could we, I would go ahead and say, you know, could we sleep with the oxen? And the peasants were marvellous. They never asked who you are, where you come from. They'd simply say, okay. And then next morning, I would say, well, we'd like to do a day's work for you. So we would do a day's work or 2 days work, and eventually we got a reputation for being very good workmen. So we would be passed on to say, oh, we've got a cousin over the hill. If you go to him, you'll be 3 days work there. So we made our way right along the Apennines, from Parma to above Pistoia, working and walking. It wasn't particularly dangerous. We found ourselves once on the road with German troops. They didn't see us. And then in November, it began to get rather cold, and I said I really thought we ought to cross the Apennines before the snows came. And so we set off up one of the passes, and were very surprised that there was no traffic coming down. We thought there might be German traffic. And we discovered why when we got to the top, the pass was actually blocked with snow. So we stopped just before the blockage and spent the night with the family there. And then we walked through very deep snow, and my companion Ted, who had been in the tropics, you know, in India and Middle East for a long time, and felt the cold badly. All we had on was just a shirt and a jacket and trousers. That was all the clothing we had. It was very cold. So I said I'd go on ahead. He was having problems. I said I'd go on ahead and see what was on the other side. So I got over the other side through the snow and came down. The snow cleared and there was a what looked like an inn of some sort on the side of the road, and I went down, walked in, found myself totally surrounded by fascist militia. There was a whole room full of them. So I sort of looked around and sort of I was looking for somebody and indicated that he wasn't there. Walked out again and got up and found Ted. And we then came down the hill and dived over the side down into a deep gully. And so we went on. We continued in this way until sometime in December. And we came to the point where the main road and the main, as it was then, and the main railway line from Florence to Bologna goes through the mountains, through the Apennines, from Prato to Bologna. Now, we knew that it was a road, a river, and a railway line that all had to be passed. We all ran next to each other in a narrow valley. And we were pretty sure this must be guarded. And we were coming down towards it. What we had was a railway map of Italy, our only way of navigating. And we came to what was a rather large village, and it looked too big for comfort, so I said, let's make a detour around it. Came around the village, and on a path, somebody came walking up towards us, and he was wearing a raincoat. And the normal thing was, on all these occasions, we'd met many, many people, and you always simply passed the time of day, you said, buongiorno, buonasera, and they would say, buongiorno, buonasera, mind their own business, and go on, but he stopped. And we said, buonasera, and he said, where are you going? And we said, well, that's none of your business, actually. And he then said, you're wearing British Army boots. And Ted, who had a big stick, had it in both hands, just right at him. And I've met this guy since. I met him again last summer, and he said he had his hand on his revolver in his raincoat. However, he said, look, it's all right. He said, I'm a liaison officer with the partisans. Took us into the village, showed us a British prisoner of war, and put us up for several days. And we were then hidden in a barn outside the village. And he then, with his wife, then took us over the railway and the river and the road and up over the mountains to partisans in the position above Florence, a place called Monte Morello, where we stayed for some time, and they then had instructions to go and join up with a larger force in the high Apennines, and we set off. Ted was separated from me. He went to go and collect some supplies and ammunition some other direction, and I went off with the leader of the formation and two Russians, the Yugoslav, and a number of young Italians.
The Russians and the Yugoslav were ex-POW, right?
Ex-POW, yes. In fact, yes. The Russians had been taken at Stalingrad. The Yugoslav was a student, and I think he may have been, I don't know quite where he came from, but he was a communist student. This was a communist formation. So we went up and we stopped the night at a barn in, quite high up in the Apennines, and we spent the evening with the family, a number of girls, and we danced and sang. And there was a village school teacher there, a woman. And the commander of the detachment and myself took her out and said, look, we don't want any trouble. So, you know, we don't know who you are. So just shut up about anything you've seen. We went to sleep in the barn at night, and I was wakened by one of the Russians who had gone out to have a pee, who said, the fascists have surrounded us. And they had indeed surrounded the barn and were shining their torches in and saying to come out. So we fought them for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours, I suppose. And then we had to make a break for it, and we broke through one of the doors. And with this Yugoslav, I went uphill. There were a lot of troops about, and we fired from there until my rifle jammed, and he was short of ammunition, and the machine gunners were ranging on us, so we went farther uphill and got over the top.
The band had broken up?
Broken up. Most of them were killed. Many of them were killed. And then we got down the other side and hid in a wood, and there a small boy came, found us, and said, "Oh, are you from the fight on the hill?" So we said, "Yes." So he said, "I'll tell my brother." His brother worked in a factory in the valley. And the brother then came up and brought us food. And then I went back to the village where I'd met the partisan liaison officer and was hidden by a family there for just over 2 months. Until one day there was fighting started just outside the village. So I got out and started walking again. And I walked south until I got near Siena. And there I was given food by a shelter by a nice old peasant. But in the night I was wakened by somebody shining a torch in my face when I was sleeping. And who spoke in Italian, but made a mistake, and I said, "Come on, you're not Italian." He turned out to be a South African prisoner who was actually living with this peasant. And he then said, "Well, we've got, who are you?" And I said, who I was. And he said, "Well, can you prove it?" I said, "No, obviously I couldn't." And I'd made the big mistake. He'd taken me to his room, and he had a Dutch Bible. And I looked at it, and he said, "You can't understand." I said, "Yes, I can. I can read German." So I was taken along to an Italian captain. There was, in fact, a monarchist unit in the area. And he said, "Well, I know the following about you. So you're a British officer. You've got a curious accent. You can read German. Now, who are you? Can you demonstrate?" So they produced, amongst them there was a Geordie prisoner of war. So I sang the Blatant Racist to him. But I didn't persuade the Italians, I guess. So they said, "Well, can you really prove your identity?" So I said, "Okay, if you send a messenger to Campi, which is a little town, little village near Florence, and you ask for the butcher, you'll find that the butcher is dead, but his widow will be there, and she knows me, and that my name is Carlino, and her husband was killed in a fight with me against the fascist militia." So they sent the messenger, and he took a week to go and come, or a week to 10 days. And he came back and said, "It's all true." And they said, "Well, that's a good job, we're going to have to shoot you." So I was then made area commander in that district of Chianti. And then we had an arms drop from the Allies. We got a BBC message. And then I was told to go into the town and make contact with the French, with the Free French when they came in, which I did, and told them what we knew about German gun positions, things of that sort. And I was then handed over to the British, who for the reason it totally escapes me, put me in a German prisoner of war cage outside Siena, which was very unpleasant. It was apart from the fact that I felt I didn't belong there. It was in a field and it was raining heavily all night and you had nothing to sleep on. Generally nasty. However, I was taken out next day and put on a truck and taken down to Civitavecchia, north of Rome. From there, by landing craft to Naples. And in Naples, there was a prisoner of war centre where I was debriefed. And in due course, shipped back to the UK.
What type of thing did they want to know at the debriefing?
What I'd been up to, what I'd done, who people were, so on.
Can I ask you a few questions about the partisan band that you operated with? About how big were they?
The one that I was with, that was broken up and destroyed, was a dozen people, I suppose. Made up. The commandant, a guy called Lanciotto, was a sergeant in the Italian army who, when the 8th of September came and the armistice, loaded as much material as he could on a truck and put it up in the mountains on the basis that you never know when you might need this. He was a communist. And he had with him two other communists. One was a bank clerk and the other was a factory worker of some kind. And then you had a number of young Italians who were really there because they didn't want to be called up into Mussolini's Republican Fascist Army. And then you had the two Russians, the Yugoslav, myself and Ted.
So these sergeants had been a sergeant in the Italian army, but a communist at the same time?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, he was a communist from way back. He and his brother were famous, even under the fascist regime, for beating up fascists. They were a very famous family. And, of course, you see, that part of Italy was absolutely red. I mean, one was totally safe with any of the workers down there. There was a place outside Florence called Sesto Fiorentino.